Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. Why is it if you Google evidence against the Big Bang, those five words, evidence against the Big Bang, that out of 7 million web pages containing those words, that Google ranks Real Science Radio as number 4 out of 7 million web pages? The reason is because we interviewed the leading scientist both for and against the Big Bang, including atheists like Lawrence Krauss, and we have perhaps the world's most complete and concise list of evidence against the Big Bang, all on one page at realscienceradio.com/Big Bang. Well, it's time to interview another brilliant scientist, because a team of astrophysicists, they've updated previous work, and they've just published in a prestigious journal measurements from about 1,000 galaxies that contradict the fundamental prediction of the Big Bang. As reported in Science News, scinews.com, quote, contrary to the prediction of the Big Bang theory, they found, this team of astrophysicists, found that the surface brightness of near and far galaxies are identical, and that's not supposed to be if the Big Bang is correct. Now, to discuss this and its implications for the Big Bang, wouldn't it be wonderful to talk to the physicist who helped develop clocks that are so accurate that, according to MIT's Technology Review, they are more accurate than our atomic clocks of just a decade ago, and they're more accurate even than pulsars? Wow, that's an accomplishment. Award-winning physicist Dr. John Hartnett has published more than 100 papers in scientific journals. Dr. Hartnett, congratulations on your work on the most accurate clocks, and welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, Dr. Hartnett, you're in Australia. We caught you at your home. Thank you for joining us. So there are these couple issues I'd like to talk to you about. One is all these galaxies that their surface brightness is not as the Big Bang predicts. And two, an article you wrote in 2011 on whether or not the universe is expanding. But could we start by you telling us a little bit about these very accurate clocks that you've worked on?
Yeah, I built, it's a cryogenically cooled sapphire oscillator. We have a large single crystal of sapphire that's cooled to around about 6 degrees above absolute zero. Essentially, you could imagine the dimensions of the crystal are frozen because it's so cold. We have a bunch of control systems on it, and we're able to build a clock that ticks the dimensions of the crystal. It's not an atomic device. It's a classical clock.
Wow.
It has a stability. Best way to think of it, it generates a regular signal like the tick-tock of a clock, where you might classify it or calculate it based on this idea of gain or lose a second. And your typical watch, a very good quartz watch, might have a stability of 1 second in a month, you know, gain or lose a second in a month, whereas my oscillator would gain or lose a second in several hundred million years. That gives you the kind of comparison.
Well, that's so exciting, Dr. Hartnett. Yeah, my daughter-in-law worked at NIST. I'm sure you've heard of the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Yep.
She was an administrator.
I knew them quite well.
Yeah, up in Boulder. And in fact, our studio clock is set by radio waves broadcast from the cesium fountain clock there in Boulder. And so you're...
Okay, well, just for your listeners, my clock is not accurate. And I know this might sound a bit strange.
Yeah.
But in time and frequency standards, we call it metrology, the science of measurement. Only an atomic clock can be accurate because of the definition of the second. My oscillator, its frequency is just determined by the dimension of the crystal, but it is precise. You understand the difference?
So,
the regularity of the tick.
Dr. Hartnett, could you tell us, how is a second defined?
Yeah, okay. So it's been since, I think it's about somewhere in the 1980s, the formal definition of the second has been shifted to an atomic standard. And that atomic standard is a certain transition in the cesium atom. That transition has a certain frequency, and that frequency, therefore, will define a second.
Okay.
And that's no longer linked to the rotation of the Earth.
Ah.
So every year, the rotation period of the Earth is corrected by adding leap seconds on, and on rare occasions, even subtracting a leap second.
Right, exactly. And because apparently it varies, and it varies with some
steady
repetition.
Yeah, it does. It wobbles on its axis, precesses, right, and the rotation period changes.
Exactly. On Friday afternoons, when we'd want to leave the studio early, we'd call my daughter-in-law and ask her, could she maybe reset the atomic clock 15 minutes so we could all go home earlier?
You can't reset it. That's the whole point, because it's that accuracy is defined by the atoms themselves. Mm. Not by environmental conditions.
So one last time, explain how your clock, with its precision, it compares to an atomic clock like up at NIST.
Okay, so it's kind of comparing apples with bananas.
All right.
A modern atomic clock, you may have heard that there's a new generation of atomic clocks that are called a fountain clock. There are actually some newer ones than that. But ones that are actually used in timekeeping,
the cesium fountain clock,
atomic fountain clock,
right?
And they cool atoms using laser cooling and launch them up vertically about a meter, so they like go up in a fountain sort of behavior. Those atoms are interrogated by a microwave signal, 9.2 gigahertz frequency. Well, the transition in the atom defines the second, hence accuracy. But how do you interrogate those atoms? You need a signal source. And so my oscillator is actually used in a number of labs. In fact, the most precise and accurate atomic clock on Earth is in Paris, the Observatoire de Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And they use one of these cryogenic sapphire oscillators as like a flywheel for engineers, like a flywheel in a car.
Right.
It helps keep the timing, because you have to interrogate those atoms about once every second. And so you can then get both stability and accuracy from your atomic clock.
And
I built these. There's one in operating in Japan, a couple of them in Japan. The Japanese now have the second most accurate and precise atomic fountain clock on Earth, because they're using my sapphire oscillator as the flywheel.
Well, congratulations for that. As I said in the intro, at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, their technology review, they mention you and your associate, Andre Luton, at the University of Western Australia, and they say, hey, atomic clocks, terrestrial clocks have been getting better over the decades, but you've got to talk to John Hartnett and his associate for the best clocks in the universe. They're even better than pulsars. So congratulations on that as a creationist. And, you know, I've heard atheists say, I don't know, dozens of times that creationists don't publish in real scientific journals. And Dr. Hartnett, you've published, 100 papers in some of the most prestigious journals. Yeah. And congratulations for that. I have here, like, in Astrophysics and Space Science, in the International Journal of Theoretical Physics, and so on.
Yeah, actually, in the one that I compared man-made clocks to pulsars is published in the Reviews of Modern Physics, which is the highest impact factor physics journal on Earth.
Oh, my.
It has an impact factor of 43, which is higher than nature.
Yeah, wow. Higher than nature? Oh, my. And I'm sure many in our audience are not familiar with the impact factor. That's standardized across all the thousands of science journals. But congratulations on that. I didn't realize that. That's just tremendous. So could we talk about, I have two things in front of me. Your 2011 paper with evidence that the Big Bang is wrong when it's claiming that the universe is expanding, that at least there's evidence that it may be wrong. And the second thing is the 2014 update on the surface brightness of galaxies, about 1,000 galaxies, where these astrophysicists who led this international team, they're saying, well, the Big Bang predictions didn't pan out because the surface brightness of the furthest galaxies is the same as the nearest galaxies.
I think you're referring to the article that I did a review of a number of different lines of evidence comparing static and expanding universe, right?
Yes, that's right.
Well, that included the Lerner et al. Paper on the surface brightness.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an expanding universe, most people, let's wind it back a bit, most people just sort of look at redshift. Okay, Hubble observed galaxies around our galaxy, measured the redshift in the light from those galaxies, and measured the distance to those galaxies, and got some sort of linear correlation between them.
Between redshift and
distance.
And
then concluded that that redshift must be like a Doppler effect, you know, like the police gun radar system. That means if the wavelengths are stretched out, which means redshifted, then they're moving away from us, and hence the idea of an expanding universe. But in cosmology, it's not really the same thing. It's not movement through space at all. The idea is that the space itself is expanding.
Hmm.
The actual universe, like the galaxies are sitting in space and they're not moving. They're stationary. Well, locally within their cluster, they might be moving, but the cluster itself is stationary. And the universe or the stuff that they're sitting in is expanding.
Dr. Hartnett, when the Big Bang Theory proponents say that the universe is expanding, they don't mean the space within our bodies. They don't mean the Earth. They don't mean the solar system or even a galaxy. They mean the space between the galaxies. Is that right?
That's right. In fact, I don't believe they even have a very good argument as why a galaxy doesn't expand. You know, the arguments usually are that the gravity within the galaxy keeps it together.
Right.
But they're talking about, you're right, that the space between the galaxies is sort of being added to, you know, it's a metrical expansion. That means the metric, the substructure of the universe itself is expanding. So the evidence for that then is the redshift, the measurement of redshift in all galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
But even Hubble himself, you know, there's quotes from Hubble, 1935, 1947, I do believe I've even read, I haven't read the quote, but others mention right up into the early 50s, he himself doubted that as a good explanation for the mechanism of redshift, you know. If you wanted to test whether the universe is expanding, then you should look for other lines of evidence. And that's what Lerner did and what others have suggested in the past. To look for other mechanisms, or let's say other lines of evidence that can test whether the universe is static or expanding.
In your 2011 paper on whether or not the universe is expanding, the case against expansion, you look at evidence from a number of different areas, the cosmic microwave background radiation, the CMB, and whether or not it's casting a shadow in the foreground of galaxy clusters. You look at the angular size of galaxies, the surface brightness of galaxies, and you also look at something called absorption lines. And as you go through each of these, you present the evidence as collected by, you know, mainstream astrophysicists, and you show that over and over, the evidence fits a static universe far better than it does, and without all these wild secondary assumptions, better than it does fit an expanding universe and the Big Bang.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the CMB, cosmic microwave background radiation, if it's from the Big Bang, that means it's from the fireball of the Big Bang. They call the last scattering surface. I mean, that's the surface from after which radiation left plasma, separated from the plasma, and it's essentially traveled through the universe unimpeded ever since. So the Big Bang, therefore, let's say that fireball should be the most distant background source in the universe. And therefore, clusters of galaxies should have sort of a shadow effect in front of them. if that is truly the most distant source.
So that, if I understand, and in your 2011 paper, you cite a study by Liu, Meidetz, and Zhang, and they looked at...
Yeah, Richard Liu, who's led that sort of work. Yeah, I think they studied 31 clusters, if I remember.
That's right.
And found that only about a quarter of them had a shadow. And statistically, that means there's no shadow, because if the source is not in the background, you would expect randomly that some clusters may have a shadowing effect if they happen to lie in front of whatever that source is.
Whatever a
source
is.
And some won't.
So, in other words,
yeah, the source is from somewhere else, you know.
So, Dr. Hartnett, I like to restate these things because if I understand it, then maybe my audience understands it. So they looked at 31 relatively nearby clusters of galaxies, not galaxies, but clusters. And they knew that if the Big Bang is true, there would be this echo of the Big Bang, so to speak. And in front of these 31 clusters, they should find a shadow so that the CMB would not be as strong. Instead,
exactly, there's a sort of a cooling effect, just like if you have a light in a lamppost, you see a shadow cast in the foreground of the lamppost, right?
Right.
There's a sort of a cooling, just like shadowing of radiation from the sun. You get behind a wall and you get a shadow cast.
Yeah, you stand under a tree in the sunlight and then it's a little cooler. And so 75% of these galaxy clusters showed no shadow of any CMB from a Big Bang. So statistically, that means there is no evidence of the shadow of the CMB, the Big Bang itself.
That's right.
That's powerful, and that's one class of evidence. You went through four different kinds of evidence.
Yeah, and probably the most powerful, in a sense, is a line of evidence that decades back, a gentleman called Tolman suggested, and that's what the Lerner et al. Paper is about, the surface brightness.
Right.
Because Tolman realized that you could test an expanding universe without testing any cosmology.
Hmm.
You see, cosmology is...
it's like voodoo.
Well, cosmology is not really science.
Right. It's almost like witchcraft.
You know, what's that?
It's almost like witchcraft. Cosmology.
Maybe so. So he came up with the idea that you needed a test that was independent of cosmology, because if you have to apply cosmology to evidence to interpret it, then you're sort of biasing it automatically, right? So it depends then on your assumptions that are in your cosmology.
Right.
And the Tolman idea was that, okay, if you look at like surface brightness, in a static universe, if you get further and further away, the objects get smaller, but the luminosity goes down too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take the density, you know, like the brightness per unit area, then that should be constant in a static universe. But if you have an expanding universe, you have a few different effects. One of them is actually a time dilation effect, which reduces the intensity. Another one is the number of photons arriving per unit time decreases, so the intensity drops off.
And then the object was closer to us when the light was emitted. Those are the...
Exactly, that's right. And so you add these together and you actually have... It depends on the type of units you use, whether you do it per unit wavelength or unit frequency or hertz or something, or in absolute units. But the difference between the two, expanding and non-expanding, are like about, goes as, at least as the cube of the redshift, which is a massive effect in an expanding universe. So much, much dimmer or much, much lower surface brightnesses should be detected as greater and greater redshifts. And the work that I did quote back there in 2011 was work that Lerner had started years ago, and they had brought to a very nice conclusion and got published in a good journal just recently, is where they sampled galaxies out to about redshift 5, which is extremely large if you Hubble law interpretation of redshift. You
know, in other words, extremely distant galaxies. And by the way, for the audience, this Eric Lerner is with the Lawrenceville Plasma Physics Center, and his paper with his team was published in the International Journal of Modern Physics, D, and they looked at about 1,000 galaxies. And so, Dr. Hartnett, what they were supposed to find, if the Big Bang is true, that if you compare equal surface units of the near and far galaxies, the far away ones should be dimmer than the nearby ones.
But that's right.
But they said, if our measurements are accurate, which most of modern cosmology would say they were accurate, they said they're the same. There's no difference. And that contradicts the expansion model of the Big Bang.
And they worked on that research for many years to try to take into account selection effects, biases that might have crept in, you know. Mm-hmm. They threw away all sorts of galaxies. They cut them out. Anywhere might cause a bias in the data, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make their samples very robust. Obviously, it's got through the reviewers and it's been published. So, you know, that was something that I mentioned actually back 3 or 4 years ago. Their work hadn't been published at that stage.
So this is an affirmation. It's a corroboration of your sense of where the data was headed back in 2011. And so this is now brand new, just published. Also, when Tolman proposed this, he did that with Hubble, Edwin Hubble. And just a few months ago, Dr. Hartnett, I read Hubble's big paper on cosmology from 1937. One of these days, I'd like to do a show just on Hubble's paper. It was so fascinating. But time and again, when we look at the evidence, we find that the evidence contradicts fundamental predictions of the Big Bang.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at Hubble's small book on observational cosmology, I think it's called, or observational astronomy.
Yeah, that was his paper.
That's about 1937.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the same one.
It is, yes. That's like 70 pages.
Well, because of his atheistic worldview, he is kind of making statements which are quite shocking, because the redshift all around him is sort of telling him, this means that we're in the center of the universe, right? Mm. But that can't be the case. And he then refers to the cosmology, and the cosmology is saying the universe is expanding. That's the solution. That's how we get out of this problem, this dilemma, which he actually called intolerable in that book.
Intolerable.
You can see the bias, you know. Because of his belief system, and that's really important for people to understand, because of a belief system, the evidence is interpreted, you know, one way or another. Nobody is without a belief system.
Right. At Real Science Radio, we've done a program, Fred Williams and I, on the cosmological principle, and we quote the world's leading astronomers and physicists, from Richard Feynman to pretty much everybody. And they all say, our claim that the universe does not have a center and that we're not in the center of the universe, it's strictly philosophical. They say we don't have evidence to show we're not in the center. We're making a philosophical commitment. I mean, that's Stephen Hawking and George Ellis, and it's everybody. Yeah. And so, but the evidence is coming in from quantized redshift that perhaps we're very close to the center, perhaps.
Well, even this axis of evil that is in the cosmic background radiation, now that's been confirmed
in
the latest data from the Planck satellite.
Yes.
That's there. I've heard Max Tegmark, who was one of the first guys to even look for this, or let's say discover it.
Yes.
He has said that the effect is out to like about the 20th multipole expansion. Mm. And now these are these way of looking at the anisotropies, the small fluctuations in temperature coming from all directions in the sky, and you can expand them out into spherical harmonic components. They're like smaller and smaller components on the sky, you know. And he's saying that in all of them, there's a preferred direction.
Right.
in space.
Right.
In the universe.
To the structure of the universe. And Dr. Hartnett, I know that you don't follow Real Science Radio from here in Denver, Colorado, but in September, Fred Williams and I, we did a show on the Big Bang Theory Goes Kerplunk on the Planck satellite and the anisotropy of the universe. And what we did was we took all the major papers, the WMAP and the Planck papers, and we excerpted them with their maps showing all these astounding, what they call it, the axis of evil, because it looks like even the Earth in our solar system is in a special place in our galaxy.
Yeah, it's important to realize, though, of course, this axis is an axis. It's not a center. It doesn't pin down a center. But nevertheless, the very fact that the axis is aligned with the plane of the solar system, and even more strangely with the equinoxes, which are sort of really two imaginary points, because the Earth's tilted axis.
Yes, Dr. Hartnett, it's an astounding thing. But then the quantized redshift, that seems to point to a center that our Milky Way would be near.
Somewhere near, yeah. Published in that, in Astrophysics and Space Science, and actually I'm still working on this. This is something that's ongoing, and we've got now the Sloan Digital Sky Survey of the Data Release 10, which is about 1 million galaxies.
Oh my, that is so exciting.
And we still find this effect. We've got shells, about 5 shells, out to redshift of about 0.2 or something like that, out to about 900 megaparsecs anyway, right? What's roughly what, about 300 million light years.
And Dr. Hartnett, we are about out of time, but I want to thank you, because so much of what I've learned about the universe has come from your work over decades. I've been reading the creationist material since the 1970s, and you've been a major contributor to so much that we've learned about God's creation. So thank you for all your work and for this really fun conversation.
Well, I hope you can use what we've said.
So, Dr. Hartnett, we're out of time. Your website, is that the best place for people to keep up with your work? johnhartnett.com?
Yes, johnhartnett.org.
Oh, johnhartnett.org. johnhartnett.org. Is that the best website to keep up with you?
Yes. Also creation.com.
That's
also.
Right. Of course, CMI. Thank you so much, Dr. Hartnett. What an honor to have you on the program.
No problem. Thanks so much, Bob.
All right. So we reached Dr. John Hartnett at his home in Australia. That was an honor. Our website, realscienceradio.com. Tune in next week. We hope that Fred Williams will be back from assignment. It'll be great to talk with him. May God bless you guys.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. By the handiwork of God, tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real, that's what I'm talking about.